is K-A-Y-T, Gina Alexandria. The gospel is on the radio at 88.1. Call up somebody. Tell them it's going to be all right. K-A-Y-T. Got the gospel transmitting all day.
This is BJ, and I would like to welcome you to our show, Just Stuff. This show is about ordinary people just like you, just like me, combining our efforts in a positive way to make our community better, one day at a time, through conversation, encouragement, resources, empowerment, and just plain talk. Remember, you are the best part of this show. Today, my guest is Nicholas, and Nicholas is in recovery from drug addiction. And I would like to share, Nicholas would like to share his story of addiction and recovery with us. And, you know, our goal is to help somebody to know that being in recovery is the place to be if there is a drug addiction. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Hello, my name is Nicholas M. My addiction started early in life. I was introduced to drugs via my cousin. Just started off simple, you know, just marijuana, in which progressed into heavy drinking. After that, I moved to California from Louisiana and started going to college, met some individuals while I was in college, and was introduced to the rave scene, which is basically techno music and drug use. Okay. And that's probably when I first noticed I might have an issue.
How old were you?
18.
Okay.
I started smoking marijuana at 16.
Okay.
But I started doing heavy drugs, ecstasy, cocaine, things like that, by the age of 18. I was still able to hold down a job early in my addiction. That didn't last. Let's put it that way. It did not last. Pretty soon I was homeless. Didn't take long, probably within a good year and a half, maybe 2 years, I dropped out of college. I was homeless and had no choice but to move back to Louisiana, mm-hmm. where my mother's from. Mm-hmm. Got back on track, still wasn't in recovery, what you would consider recovery. I was just sober, mm-hmm. And miserable.
Okay.
Totally miserable.
Why were you miserable, you think?
I missed it.
You missed the drugs.
I missed the drugs. You know, I missed the way they made me feel.
Okay.
I missed the scene, the fun that I used to have. You know, I started doing drugs because it was fun. But it doesn't stay fun for long. It really doesn't. I mean, if it wasn't fun when I first did it, I wouldn't have done it again. But the problem being is, you know, I moved back here and I'm isolating. You know, I'm just gonna stay to myself. I'm not gonna socialize with anybody that I used to know, and everything's gonna be okay. But it's not okay. You know, because I wasn't okay with me. You know, I didn't like who I was. And that was the real core of the problem. Once I got into recovery later on in life, I discovered that the real problem wasn't the drugs or the alcohol. The real problem was me. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a church home. My stepfather was a minister. Mm-hmm. So I can't really blame my upbringing. I was taught better. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I fell victim to my own devices. Like I say, I moved back to Louisiana. My cousin, who lived in Arizona, told me she needed a roommate. So I was like, well, okay, I'll move to Arizona. Why not? I've never been there before. Mm-hmm. So I moved to Arizona, and I start working for a computer company out there, mm-hmm. making good money. But I had never dealt with my addiction. And it was
like
only,
you said, you were sober.
I was sober.
But not in recovery.
Right. I never dealt with my addiction, so the day came when my addiction dealt with me. I found myself living in what's commonly, I guess, referred to as a trap house. You know, I'm still working the job, and I was introduced to methamphetamines mm-hmm. while living in Phoenix. And my roommate introduced me to the needle, and that's when I was introduced to intravenous use. Mm-hmm. And after that, it was a downhill slide. I mean, I have these things, what I tell people today is we have these things called lines of morality. These, I've never done this, I'm not gonna, you know, I've never done that, that hasn't happened. And we cross these lines, you know. Before I smoked my first, you know, joint, I was never gonna do drugs. Mm-hmm. I was 14, 15 years old, and I was never gonna do drugs. I see what it did to people. I was mm-hmm. never gonna do that, mm-hmm. you know, and then I started smoking pot. You know, but, you know, I would tell myself, it's like, well, you just smoke a pot. It's not like you're an addict, you know. You're not a junkie, mm-hmm. you know.
Rationalizing.
I would rationalize it to myself that I would see the differences. I would not look for the similarities in how I behaved, how I acted. But like I say, once I start crossing these lines of morality, you know, I'm doing harder drugs, then I'm injecting drugs. And it led me to down a road that there was no way out of at the time that I believed, mm-hmm. you know. I just figured that's what I was supposed to be doing, you know. I had a real negative self-image of myself because of these lines, you know. I crossed my own lines, things that I said I would never do.
Then did guilt pay a part
in
that?
And the guilt of me doing this made mm-hmm. me feel bad. Mm-hmm. Well, as a person, I don't want to feel bad.
Right.
You know, I want to feel good about myself, or I want to just feel good. If I can't feel good about myself, I just want to feel good. Mm-hmm. And then that's would lead to more drug use.
Is it chasing a high? You get high, but then the high that you have is not enough anymore, so you go, you use something else to give you a greater high than the one you had before.
Correct.
So you're always chasing
right.
that first high.
That you'll never get again.
That you'll never get again.
And you will. You will chase that. You will chase the next best thing, the better thing. You're going to mm-hmm. always want more. Because when I was high all the time, that became my normal. Mm-hmm. That was normal to me. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to get high, I needed to do something stronger. I left Phoenix, moved back out to California, cleaned up, you know, went back to just smoking pot. You know, I figured I was just going to use the old marijuana maintenance, and that doesn't work. You know, I tell people, it's like, marijuana maintenance really doesn't work because I'm still using an exterior solution for my interior problem. I have a problem on the inside. I have a hole inside of me that I need filled. And drugs, people, I try to fill this hole with things that that cannot fill it. It wasn't until...
Well, how did this impact your family? When did your family find out what you were doing?
My mom had always suspected it since I was smoking pot as a kid, but she could never prove it. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, I would always deny it, you know, but my mom's not dumb. You know, she knew what was going on. She didn't know how to handle the problem. She really didn't. And it took her years before she realized how to handle the problem. And she realized that she couldn't. My mom introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, mm-hmm. to AA. Mm-hmm. And how she found out about it is she had been going to Al-Anon, mm. which is a support group
right.
for people. And what she learned there was that she had been enabling me my whole life, you know, bailing me out of jail, you know, and paying my electric bill because, you know, I would come up with some sob story of like, I can't pay my electric bill this month, but if you could pay the electric bill, you know, and she would pay the electric bill company directly, thinking that she was helping me. What was really happening was, if I don't have to pay the electric bill, I can spend my money on drugs. And my mom can pay the electric bill, or my dad can pay the electric bill, you know, and I could spend my money on what I really wanted. You know, that's a form of enabling. It actually hurts the person way more than helping them.
And I believe that, but the thing is with parents, they love their children so much, they just want the best for them, and they do the things that they think is gonna help them the most, when actually it's not.
You will love them to death.
To death.
And that's a very true statement.
That's true.
My mom had, like I told you, my mom had gotten involved with Al-Anon while I was locked up. Mm-hmm. I was locked up in Lafayette for doing things that I shouldn't have been doing. Mm-hmm. And I, at the time, I had money in my bank account, but I couldn't bond myself out. I couldn't sign my own bond papers.
Oh.
It was only $130 to bond me out, and I had close to about 10 grand in the bank. And I had to sit there for 90 days because I couldn't get nobody to sign the papers for me. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. It truly was. And now at the time, I wasn't very happy about mm-hmm. it. But my mom had learned through Al-Anon that if she was going to bond me out, she was just enabling me again, because I wasn't going to stop. I really wasn't. I moved to St. Louis, you know, and still practicing my marijuana maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
That was always my fallback for the longest time, was
the marijuana maintenance?
The marijuana. Mm-hmm. I would always be like, well, it's just pot, you know. I would justify it to myself. It's just pot. But what I've learned is it's never going to be enough. I'm not going to just stop at just pot. If I'm going to get just some pot, well, tomorrow I'm going to go just get me some alcohol too, and then I'm going to go get something else. But St. Louis is where my addiction really, I would say, peaked, is I was introduced to heroin.
Mm.
And that is, it's a
terrible.
It's a totally different game. It really yes. is. And it's a game you can't win. I'd gotten pretty bad.
Heroin is cheaper, so it's easier access.
Yeah, in St. Louis, it's, yeah. That's one of the crux of the problems, you know? Because like we were talking about earlier, it's like you're always chasing the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's nothing to chase after heroin. You're at the top, and or at the bottom, I should say. Mm-hmm. You're at the bottom.
Did you ever try to detox on your own?
Yes.
How did that work?
That was very difficult. It was very hard.
Did you have a support system when you tried to detox on your own?
I've detoxed in jail before, and there's no real support there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, really rough. I've detoxed at home. My mom came and basically rescued me from St. Louis. Mm-hmm. She knew something was going on. You know, she could tell it in my voice. She could tell it in the pictures that I would send her. You know, at the time, I'm not thinking I have any issues. You know, I'm thinking everything's hunky-dory. But people who've known me my whole life are just watching me wither away. I'm kind of a bulky guy, as you can tell.
Mm-hmm.
I was down to 155 pounds.
Oh, my.
I was skin and bones at the time. And when my mom saw that, she came from here. She's from Alexandria.
Mm-hmm.
She drove all the way to St. Louis overnight. Came and grabbed me and my cat, and I left. And I came back home, you know, and I told her that I had to go to my friend's house to pick up something of mine.
Here we go again.
Was drugs, because I wasn't going to detox in the car ride. That's the mentality. The mentality of it is
my.
It's insanity. It's pure
it
insanity.
Is.
So here I am driving back, or riding back from St. Louis, risking my entire family's freedom because I've got heroin in the car.
Oh my.
But that's not what I was worried about. I was worried about me. I didn't want to feel bad, you know. I knew once I got home I was going to have to detox. I was going to have to get clean. So I made sure I had enough that I could make it home with. And I did. Luckily, you know, we didn't get pulled over or anything. And we get back home and I got a detox on the couch, you know. And that was probably one of the roughest detoxes I've ever gone through, was the opiate detox. That one was, it feels like you're gonna die. It really does. It feels like somebody's trying to pull your insides out. It's traumatic. It's something I'll never forget.
My.
But
was that enough?
No. I was gonna say, but that wasn't the end, you know? Because I still wasn't in recovery. I was just sober.
So what is what's the most dangerous thing that you've done while under the influence?
Wow, that's a very long list. I mean, I've driven my car off the road intentionally trying to kill myself, trying to hit a tree and get out in the ditch and miss the tree. I've, not my proudest moments, but I've broken into somebody's house before not knowing if they were there. They were owning a gun, you know. It's the things that you don't care about
anymore. You don't care about anymore.
Right, because I'm no longer in control.
The drugs.
The drug is in control. And I know that sounds like a cop-out answer, but it's true. I will do, when I'm in active addiction, I will do anything I have to do. I mean, if you were to look at my criminal record before I got in recovery, I had 15 pending felonies.
Oh my.
Countless misdemeanors. I had 25 separate bookings downtown. It means rode in the back of the cop car 25 times. Still wasn't enough. It didn't stop me. My dad had died and left me quite a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that just fueled my addiction. It really did, because, like I told you, I was sober. I wasn't in recovery. The first step for my recovery was admitting that I had no control, that I was powerless over it.
So how did you finally admit that, Nicholas? When did you realize you had reached your bottom and you didn't want to do that anymore?
Okay. I remember one day when I realized that I had no control over it,
mm-hmm.
I was driving to meet the individual that used to sell me heroin here in Alexandria,
mm-hmm.
With tears in my eyes, crying, because I didn't want to do it, but I couldn't stop. Crying when I handed that man all my money. And I drove to the Walmart parking lot on Mall Drive and sat in my car crying while I did it. Couldn't stand to look at myself in the mirror, but I couldn't stop. I could not stop myself from doing it. But, I mean, I wish I could say that was the end, but that was the beginning of the end for me. That was my key moment, I believe. Because I look back at that moment that, you know, they say the first step in recovery is admitting you're powerless and my life's unmanageable. And there was no greater clear-cut case of powerlessness for me than the fact that I did not want to do any of that, but I couldn't stop. Going into drug court, when I went into drug court, it added structure to my life that I needed. It added accountability, you know? I was monitored. I don't know if you're familiar with drug court.
No, I'm not.
A lot of people say, you know, drug court's a bad thing and it's a setup. And, you know, drug court, along with AA and NA, gave me back my life. It really did. I mean, drug court was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. It really was.
And you weren't incarcerated during that time, or?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I just had to report in every day. But it's what I needed. In drug court, I'd tried to go to rehab once before.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
before I got into drug court, I tried to go into rehab, but I didn't want to go to rehab. My mom wanted me to go to rehab. Mm-hmm. And in order for me to get my inheritance, I had to go to rehab. So.
You went?
Just to get the money. Just to get my mom off my back. You know? Once I got into drug court sent me to rehab. Mm-hmm. And it took that time, you know? It really did. I got, because I wanted it. I finally had gotten to the point where I wanted. Mm-hmm. I wanted to stop.
You made the choice.
Yes, I made the choice. No, drug court may have sent me, but I went to drug court and asked them to send me. I was like, look, I need y'all to send me somewhere. I can't stop while I'm still on the streets. It's almost impossible to actually stop while you're still associating with the same kind of people.
So did you do that? Did you change your people, places, things?
That was probably the second hardest thing I ever had to do. Say goodbye to people that I loved.
Because it was a different kind of family, but that was family to you.
It really was.
That was your drug family.
It really was. And they looked out for me. I looked out for them, you know?
And yeah, the drug family has that camaraderie. Mm-hmm. And they stick together and share and love each other.
Yeah. Misery loves company. Mm-hmm. It really does. But that was probably one of the harder things I've ever had to do, was not be able to talk to them anymore. You know, there's a few people that I used to, like say, I used to hang out with that I still talk to, but that's because they're sober now too.
Oh, okay.
And that's always a great thing. When you see somebody that, you know, was throwing their life away right alongside with you, to see them turn it around, mm-hmm. it inspires you. And when they see me, it inspires them. Mm-hmm. You know, because it lets us know that it is possible. Mm-hmm. You know, because I was hopeless. I really was. I couldn't have stopped on my own.
So how hard is it to stay in recovery?
Early on, it can be difficult. If you're still holding on to the idea that you're going to still be able to talk to the same people and go to the same places and hang out and you're just going to be strong, I'm going to promise you, the drugs are stronger. They are. It's not going to be able to happen that way. There's a reason why that's a saying, is change your people, places, and things. Mm-hmm. Because you have to.
That influence is just still there.
Right.
Haunting.
You're going to start what I call romancing it. Mm. You're going to remember all the good times. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to remember the 25 times I wound up downtown, locked up behind bars. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to remember having to steal from somebody, you know, to get what I needed. I'm not going to remember those things. I'm going to remember all the good times. Mm-hmm. But few there were. It was mostly just chaos.
And a lot of them, I'm sure, you didn't even remember.
I run into people today that know me, and I have no idea who they are. But they know who I am, you know? I mean, but I have no idea who they are anymore, because I'm not the same person I was.
My. So do you ever feel uncomfortable talking about or reliving your addictions, your struggles?
Early on, I had some issues, you know, when I was still kind of holding on to early in sobriety. Mm-hmm. I was still holding on to the ideas that, you know, one day I might go back to it, or, you know, and early on it crosses your mind. But having, you know, a few 24 hours under my belt now, I don't have a problem talking about it to people, you know, because I feel like if I can talk to somebody and they can relate to where I was, you know, and mm-hmm. to see where I'm at now, mm-hmm. show that it's possible. Mm-hmm.
You know? That's powerful. In your opinion, do you think that there's a serious drug problem among the youth in any area, and why?
Most definitely in this area. There is a huge drug problem in this area. A lot of kids are introduced to heavier drugs earlier on. You know, like I had told you, when I was a kid growing up, you know, all thing around was marijuana, you know? Mm-hmm. But nowadays, kids have, you know, access to much harder drugs, and they're doing them a lot younger. I mean, I remember when I was using, there was, like, 13, 14-year-olds coming around getting high already on the needle. You're 13 years old and on the needle already. I mean, it's tragedy. And it's almost heartbreaking, you know, because the person's given up on themselves before they even had a chance.
That's hard.
It is.
That's hard. excuse me. How have you changed since you've been in recovery? And is it truly one day at a time?
I would say how I've changed is I'm a responsible, productive part of society today. Whereas all I did was take, today I'm able to give. I'm able to help people. I'm able to work a job. I mean, a couple years ago, I was nowhere near the word employable. I mean, you wouldn't want to walk on the same side of the street as I was on, you know? That's how I looked. That's how mm-hmm. I personified myself.
Mm-hmm.
But today, you know, I'm able to give hope to people. At least I hope I am, you know, to show them that it's possible to do, to come be a productive part of society again. And it's rewarding to be able to help people, you mm-hmm. know, to earn an honest living today, you know, makes me happy.
So,
and it is, I would say it is one day at a time. I can't plan for, I do not know what's going to happen tomorrow, and I can't do nothing about yesterday. All I have is today.
Is today.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. So, are you ever treated in a negative way among your peers because of your recovery? And are you considered in recovery the rest of your life?
I don't get treated negatively by my peers. I did, you know, when I was in active addiction, mm-hmm. you know, people would look down on me, you know, I would look down on myself. I put myself in that situation though, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I would definitely say I'm in recovery for the rest of my life. I'll always be an addict. I will always be an addict and an alcoholic. What I really have is just a temporary reprieve from a hopeless state of mind, where I think that's the only choice